Om Ajnati Mirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha.
The subject of this evening's lecture is graduation and beyond, because I'm told that quite a few of you are passing out. Is that right? Who's passing out? Some are passing out. Yeah. Passing out means fainting. It also means you may faint when you hit the real world. You're graduating. Well, congratulations. You've worked hard. And now you're, as a result of working hard, you will now be able to work hard for the rest of your life. That's what graduation means. The opportunity to work hard, harder and harder. And this is called being a success. If you can after all this work you get so many diseases, then you can afford to go to Apollo Hospital. That is the sign of being a success. Because you have enough money, and now you're sick to death from working so hard, and you can afford to go to a prestigious hospital. Graduation. Well, it's considered a great success. In Shastra, we are coming from a completely different background. You're coming from the background of speculative science. That means, science means people talking as if they know something when they don't really. And Shastra means speaking what is actually the fact, because it's coming from the person who made this whole universe. And science means, like I say, they talk like they know, but every so often they have a paradigm shift, and then what was previously considered correct is no longer considered correct, and it goes on like that, and it's called science. But Shastra means that which is not subject to human intelligence, that which does not change. In the whole universe, it means change. Jagat. Jagat. Yogacchati iti jagat. Jagat means that which is always moving. Everything's always moving. Just like you see the trees, they may look still, but there's so much activity. The cells are moving within the cells, the molecules and atoms are moving within the atoms. It's all movement. So jagat means that which is moving. Microcosmically, macrocosmically, everything is moving. But the basic facts remain the same. The basic fact of this universe, it's summarized by Lord Krishna in two words. How about that? You want a theory of everything? Here's the theory of everything. The whole universe is summarized in two words in Bhagavad Gita. Dukhalayam ashashvatam. Lord Krishna states that this material world is a place of misery, and everything here is temporary. Everything is temporary. Nothing remains eternally. Everything is subject to change. Even the whole universe, it is destroyed in due course of time. Modern science, because it came out of the Christian background, they have the concept of linear time. That the universe was created or came into being, and that at some point in time it will finish. So that's there in the Vedic concept also, but it's not linear, it's circular. That means that after destruction, there's again creation. What appears to be a line at a short distance, at a long distance, it may be seen to be a curve, as you all know. The earth appears to be flat, but if we examine from a long distance, we'll see it's curved. So time, we have the concept of time as the universe came into being and it will eventually finish. And that's true. But the Vedic concept, or not exactly concept, again it's knowledge given by the person who set this all up, is that there is creation, and then after what seems to us like a massive length of time, there is the whole universe is destroyed, And then again there is creation. Srishti, Stiti, Pralay. The words are there. Creation, maintenance, and destruction. And then again, creation. And then again, maintenance. Then again, destruction. So the living beings within this material world, they are, everyone is spiritual by nature. The nature of this material world, it's all, everything is there. That the nature of this material world, it is composed of eight elements. These are described in Bhagavad Gita. Bhumirapanalo vayu kangmano buddhirevacha ahankara itiyang me bhina prakritir ashtata. Eight elements. What's the latest count of elements in the periodic table? They create new elements from time to time. What's the latest? Anyone know? You're up on that? They create new radioactive, unstable elements, which they're not really elements because they don't have a. They're not stable. They can't exist independently. So there, according to the Western concept of elements, there are more than 100. In the Vedic concept, there are 8. But the Vedic concept of element is different to the modern concept. The Vedic concept means there are 8. Generic kinds of substances, which are earth, water, air, fire, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. Ether means it's the most subtle of the gross elements. It is space, it is the space within which everything else moves or exists. And mind, intelligence, and false ego. These are the subtle elements. And then, aparaya mitastvanyang prakritim vidhime param jiva bhutang mahabaho yayedam dharyate jagat. And the jagat, the, everything is moving because of spirit. The material elements are there, but everything is moving. What gives motion is ultimately spirit. Spirit means that which is satchidananda, that which is by nature eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. That is the jiva, that is part of Bhagavan, who is Satchidananda, who is great, and the jiva is very small. When the jiva comes in contact with the bhutik prakriti, apara prakriti, the external energy, the material energy of the Supreme Lord, then he becomes in an incompatible situation of identifying with nature, which we don't actually have any link with this nature, this material nature, in which everything here is asat, achit, nirananda. Everything here is temporary, everything here is covered by ignorance, and everything here is of the nature of misery. So, to be a success, I didn't forget, I said the Vedic concept of success. You might have thought I forgot that, but we're just coming round back to that. The Vedic concept of success is not to become temporarily an apparently successful manipulator of the material energy, which is what is called a success in modern life. If you're a scientist or a businessman or someone who can get some money or position and apparently be a manipulator of the material energy, that is called a success. Although actually we are manipulated by the material energy. You might think, well, I'm a big success because I have a big house which is all air conditioned. But the fact is that it's damn hot outside, so we have to have, in a small space we can make some air conditioning. Or you may think, I'm very successful, I'm in control of so many people in the company. But if you have diarrhea, then you don't have control over your emotions. So we are controlled by material nature. We grow old. We don't like to grow old, but we are forced to grow old and to die. So success in the Vedic concept is not to nourish the illusion that I am the controller of the material energy. It's just an illusion. But to come to realize that this is an illusion, that is success. To stop trying to be a success in the material success, in the material sense, and understand that my real success is to come to the platform of Satchidananda, eternity, bliss, a knowledge, the spiritual platform, beyond birth and death. This material world is dukhalayam ashashvatam. It is full of misery, and everything here is temporary. But real success is parastasmat bhavo nyo vyakto vyakto sanatana yasya sarveshu bhuteshu nashachu navinashati. Real success is to go beyond this material world where everything is created and maintained and destroyed again and again and again, and to come to the spiritual world where there is no destruction and no distress. Now you may say, well, that's just religion. That's just some kind of faith. And in science we deal with knowledge. That's what people think, isn't it, usually? That religion is faith and science is knowledge. Isn't that what you're brought up to think? Is it? Religion is just some sentimental faith and science is knowledge. But actually, all knowledge is based on faith. What we call knowledge, it's all based on faith. You wouldn't have even come and enrolled in this IIT if you didn't have faith that you could learn something here. How many people here believe in electrons? No one. You're all quantum physicists. You all believe in electrons. How many people here have seen an electron? Well, why do you believe in it? You have faith, right? But you would say, well, that's a reasonable faith because you can ascertain it. How do you ascertain the existence of electrons? Can someone tell me in layman's language, because I'm not a scientist? Can you say it in popular scientific book format? How is the existence of electrons ascertained? Not theoretically or mathematically, but practically. Is there any way? There must be some way, otherwise it's just complete speculation. Well, it seems that you don't know, but you all believe in electrons, right? It's based on faith. And you may say, well, someone somewhere knows the proof and they can demonstrate it, but you don't know who that is or what the proof is. So you accept it on faith. Well, you may say that, well, it is ascertainable, but to ascertain it you have to go through so many years of study, because if you show the proof to a layman, generally there should be two kinds. There should be theoretical, which is based on mathematics, and practical. There should be some kind of experiment to demonstrate what the mathematical theory shows, right? But if you show the experiment which shows the existence of electrons, you can't actually see them, but which demonstrates that the electrons, to a layman, he won't understand it. You have to be highly educated in a specialized line, and it takes years of education to be able to understand the proof, right? So everyone, a few people can understand it, and everyone else accepts it on faith. And actually, like I was saying, in science, there's always paradigm shifts. There was pre-Newtonian science, we don't even call that science. Practically, Newton might be considered the father of modern science. But previous to that, they thought it was science. They thought it was all really good. They thought they were really scientific. And of course, I mean, we say knowledge, but at the higher levels of science, the scientists all disagree because it becomes so theoretical in various branches. So it's the same. You may say, well, religion is just a faith, but we say no, it's knowledge. It's verifiable. But you can't expect with this knowledge, which is very subtle, that anyone can understand it very easily. Just like the more subtle the knowledge is, the more training you have to take to understand it. 1 + 1 = 2, well, you don't have to be very intelligent. You don't have to go to IIT to understand that. If you don't understand it, you're definitely not going to get anywhere near IIT. So the simple stuff everyone's eligible for, but then as it gets, as the courses get more difficult, the numbers going to them become less, right? Simple mathematics, well, an uneducated woman selling bananas on the street, she knows enough, it's mathematics also, how to, sell 10 rupees of bananas and give 90 rupees change. So she knows that much. She doesn't know how to write 10 plus 90 equals 100, but she knows it. But and then you have basic mathematics, which everyone, and then you get algebra, trigonometry, geometry, and then on and on and on. And then and then the numbers of people studying that become less and less and less. And when everyone's heard of E equals MC squared, but hardly anyone understands it. But we accept it on faith. So similarly, we may say that, well, we just think religion is a kind of faith, but it's a kind of faith no more than what is called science. Actually, it's a better kind of faith, because like I say, in science, it's changing all the time, because it's based on human perception and human intelligence, which is highly limited, after all. The most intelligent people accept that our knowledge is limited. That's the first sign of limit, of intelligence. Amanitvam adambitvam. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that real knowledge begins with humility. If you think I know a lot, that's the first sign that you don't know a lot. And if you think I know very little, then either you know a little or you know a little more than anyone else. And even if you do know a lot, it's still a little, because knowledge is so vast. Newton, who was the biggest genius of his times, and even though his theories have to a large extent been superseded, still he was a genius. And you know, however big an IITian you may be, you're not going to be as big a genius as Newton. It's unlikely. But he said that he was considered the greatest genius of his time, and he said that while surveying the realm of knowledge, I feel like I'm walking on a vast beach and picking up a few grains of sand. That's what I know. So a really intelligent person, the first thing he understands is the limit of his ability to understand. And that's practically seen in human society, that what we call, since the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, I mean, after all this science you're studying, it came up in the Western world. So we're talking about Western history, Western cultural history here. Although it's not that there was not science in the Vedic tradition either. I mean, we have the words in Sanskritum, Paramanu, that means they know what is the atom. Actually, what was called the atom, it's not the atom, because the atom comes from the Greek word meaning the smallest particle. But then it's, if you say subatomic, it immediately, it doesn't mean, it's meaningless actually. If you see the etymological root of the word atom, atom means paramanu. It means the small, paramanu means supremely small. So the word is there, vimana. There are descriptions in the Vedic literature of vimanas, not like these big noisy jets that you have to put fuel into them and then they crash or they make a big noise and pollute everything. But vimanam, powered by eco-friendly mantra. That by mantra, by sound, which is subtle, by sound one can influence gross matter. That is a science which is lost to modern man. To a large extent it's lost. But previously people had the purity, because it's a subtle science. It requires purity of character and precise training, so that by uttering certain sounds, a person who has a high level of purity in his character, he can influence gross matter. So that is a subtle science. There's so much there. There's medical science, science of warfare. There are so many sciences which are to a large extent lost, and in the Western world, they have developed a gross science. In the Eastern world, it was subtle science. In the Eastern world, it's a very gross. Just like, for instance, in medicine, in the Ayurveda, it's understood that disease is caused by disorder of the kapha, pitta, vayu. And that you may, for instance, you may have some boils, but the root cause is usually that's excess pitta. That would be. But even the excess pitta, that may be even more deeply because of an imbalance of the kapha. So the three dosha, they have to be balanced as far as possible. If someone has a pitta-dominated prakriti, you can't fully make it balanced, but so that the gross imbalance is corrected and then the disease will go away. It goes right to the root of the problem. But in modern medicine, what do? They give you some antibiotics. They only the surface is seen. Only the surface disease is seen, and it destroys the organisms which are causing the problem, but it also destroys all your all the white blood corpuscles and your immune system, so you get more sick actually, and the poison which is in the system gets spread around the body. It doesn't clean it out. So be careful of antibiotics. It really messes up your immune system. I'm happy to say I haven't taken any for many years. Sometimes, you know, you just have to suffer the disease. It's better than suffering the effect of the medicine later on. So anyway, that's just an example that it's not that in Vedic culture there is lack of knowledge. Rather, there was tremendous knowledge which to a large extent has been lost. And in the Western world, they developed the knowledge based on the gross system of science means observation, hypothesis. We saw this, we saw this, we saw this. Let's try to fit it into some paradigm. So you make some paradigm, some theory, and then you experiment to see if it fits. And if it doesn't fit, you either reject the paradigm or you adjust it a little bit, or you adjust your research figures, and then it fits. That's one way to get ahead in science, as long as you don't get caught. Just adjust the figures. So, and this is how science goes on. And then there's a paradigm, and everything fits nicely, but then they do more experiments and they find some things that don't fit and they call it an anomaly and they try to pretend it doesn't exist, and then they find more anomalies and they try to pretend those that don't exist, and then all of a sudden they have a big problem and they don't know what to do. And then someone is taking a bath and he says, "Eureka!" And he comes up with a new paradigm which seems to fit nicely. But then again, you do more experiments and or someone disagrees with that paradigm, and this is the world of science. It's speculative. So it's not really knowledge. We can't say it's total ignorance, because definitely some knowledge is there, but it's coming from the platform of human observation, which is limited and incorrect. It's like, without understanding the spiritual platform, it's like seeing in 2D. A person who has two-dimensional vision, they just can't imagine what three dimensions are. So without understanding the spiritual aspect, we are crippled, actually. Our whole vision of it remains beyond our ability to conceive what is the extra dimension. That is called turiya in Sanskrit. Turiya means the fourth dimension. The dimension... Well, there's... the three dimensions in Vedic understanding, space, which is only one of them. So we say, usually we think of three dimensions as, what is that? Height, depth, and length. Height, width, and length. But in the Vedic culture, that forms, or in Vedic science, that it's a different perspective. That is considered one dimension. And the other two are time and thought. Thought means the, well, everyone knows it. It means the ability to perceive and to process what we perceive. But beyond time, space, and thought is the fourth dimension, which is spirit, which is beyond mundane time, space, and thought. It's not that there's no thinking in spirit, but it's beyond material measurement. Actually, science means measurement, doesn't it? It means to try to measure everything. Galileo said, what is that he said? That everything should be measured. And if something is not measurable, make it measurable. Mm-hmm. That's like in the Greek, what's that? There was one god who, what was his name? I can't remember. Procrustean, yeah. Procrustes. So he had beds. If you didn't fit the bed, he made you fit it. He'd either crush you or pull you. Nasty guy, huh? So modern science is like that, Procrustean. It wants to fit everything within its theory. But spirit, by its very nature, doesn't fit within material vision, because that's the very nature of spirit, is non-material. So if you say, material science, as it's evolved in the Western world, means that if we can't perceive it, it doesn't exist. Isn't that a foolish idea? Because we, with our very limited sensual perception and our very limited intelligence, can't perceive of something with our material mind, or we can't conceive it with our material intelligence. Therefore, we don't accept that it exists, and we call religion faith. It's just blind faith. But that's blindness, to deny that there can be anything beyond what we perceive with our highly limited faculties. That's blindness. That's called Maya. Ma means not, and Ya means which is. So that which is not is called Maya. Another definition of Maya is mapiyate aneya, the attempt to measure everything. If we think we shall measure everything, that is Maya, because spirit, specifically the Supreme Spirit, Bhagavan, he is immeasurable. He is anoraniyan mahato mahiyan. He's bigger than the biggest and smaller than the smallest. So success, we're supposed to be graduation, success. Yes, success in the true sense of the term means to come to, well, let's see, in material terms, success means to get to a high position. Huh? Well, spiritual success means to come to the highest position, which means beyond birth and death, out of this material illusion. Success means, if one is successful, one should be very knowledgeable, isn't it? But if one is knowledgeable only within a limited sphere, what is the value of that? Just like Dr. Frog. This is another example from the ancient Vedic culture. It's called Kupamandukya Nyai. There is a frog in a deep well, and he is considered among the frog community he's the genius. He knows everything about the well, which is 2 meters wide and 20 meters deep. He knows every little bump and every little. He knows where to find the best worms and when the insects come down. And he knows, he's a genius. He knows how to jump this way and that way. Frogs, they jump. Did any scientist ever explain that? Why don't frogs jump like this? Maybe avoiding getting caught by the snake. That they also don't do. That's another Vedic Manduka Gati Nyai, how a frog jumps like this. So among the frogs, Dr. Frog, PhD, is considered a genius. But he only knows about the little well that he lives in. And among the frog community, they think, you know, this is it. This is the whole universe. Beyond this, they don't have any concept of universe. This is everything. And one time a cosmopolitan frog from the big world outside the well comes jumping in and tells them about, well, I saw the ocean. What's the ocean? Well, it's a big body of water. Big body of water? You mean bigger than our, you know, our well's big, you know. It's 2 meters wide and 20 meters deep. How big's your ocean? Well, it's, you know, it's far bigger than this well. What do you mean? 2 times bigger? No, much bigger. 10 times bigger? No, thousands of times. Who's this idiot? He's just some madman. What does he think he is, telling us we never saw anything like that. How can there be anything like that? So modern science, because to us, we see only this tiny little universe, and we think in our frog-like way that we have amassed so much information, we know so much, we're all Dr. Frogs. So success, real success, means to get out of this froggish, limited mentality and come to the unlimited. And first of all, before we start measuring everything, measuring velocity and density and how many T's are there? I mean, you know, how many ohmmeters are there? I don't know. You must be knowing. Hygrometer, hydrometer, so many. Speedometer. What do they had? They had that in England when I was a kid. They introduced this. They had some fancy name for it. The police, when they catch you driving like a frog, they catch you and stick the breathalyzer some in you, and then they see how much alcohol you have, and then they take away your driving license. So there are so many instruments, and we think we understand so much. But to come to the platform of the unlimited, knowledge of the unlimited, that is real success. That is, we're studying so many things, measuring this, measuring that, but the first thing we should see, what's the purpose of it all? What are we doing this all for anyway? Now you're going to graduate and go out and you may get a job in America and hope you don't get shot dead. Someone might, you know. It's a very democratic country. They didn't single out anyone in particular. It's all kinds of different groups. They just shoot them all. Democratic genocide. So, you go to America, earn money. When you come back to India, be considered prestigious, and then die, and your photo might be in the newspaper if you're a success. And then what? And then it's all over. Who said, Dr. Frog? Everything's finished. When the body is finished, everything is finished, says Dr. Frog. They don't know, but they just presume. They presume and they say with the air of scientific authority, there is no such thing as soul. The body is just a combination of, life is just a combination of chemicals. And so, you know, science has proved. Science hasn't proved any such thing. They're bluffing you. If science says that life is a combination of chemicals, what is it? There's observation, hypothesis, and experimentation for verification. So, if life is simply a combination of chemicals, then we ask our scientific friends, you kindly mix some chemicals together and make some life. You don't have to make, you know, Aishwarya Rai immediately, but you can make one mosquito, for instance. I mean, there are already plenty of them in Chennai, and you know, you can swat it when you've created it. Shouldn't be too. I mean, material nature creates, it seems, millions every day in Chennai alone. So, with all the scientists in the world who are saying life is a combination of chemicals, they should be able to produce one mosquito. Shouldn't be such a difficult thing, should it? Oh, wait a minute, I forgot. They told us they're going to do it in the future. That's right, in the future. Well, anyone can say in the future. It's what's called a bluff. Anyone can say we'll do it in the future. But is there any sign? It's like, yeah, well, we discovered DNA and RNA, and we're doing cloning. But can you produce even one cell? Let's go down a long way from a mosquito to a cell. Well, that's a big, big jump, isn't it? I mean, a mosquito is a very high. Compared to a single cell, a mosquito is an incredibly complex organism. Well, when I was at school, in the biology class, they taught that a cell is a simple organism, and soon we will be producing them in the laboratory. So in my biology exam, I wrote, a cell is a simple organism, and soon we will be producing it, and tick. Okay, got it right. If you give the same answer nowadays, cross. Failure. Because they did more research and they found that even the simplest cell is far more complex than they can even begin to understand. So, they say it's a combination of chemicals. So, you have the chemicals, you have your billions of dollars of research projects, and if you just stop spending all your billions of dollars on different ways to destroy life, which is what most of the research seems to go for, different chemical weapons and different kinds of weapons and defense systems, which means how to kill people. They euphemistically call it defense systems. Then you could maybe get on with the business of creating life. But then, is there any scientist anywhere? Is there one scientist in the whole world who's trying to create life or to stop death? No, not a single one. It just underlines their bluff. That they say that life is a combination of matter, but if it is, then they should at least be trying to produce some life from matter and stop the present life from passing out, dying. But they're not even researching it. They're not even thinking of researching it. So it's a big bluff. What it means is that intrinsically they know that life is not a product of matter. If they really believe that life is a product of matter, they should be making some kind of inquiry into it, isn't it? And what is the nature of life? What is the if they really believe that life is ultimately a combination of chemicals, then they should investigate what is the chemical nature of life. But they're not doing that. So it's like, in a roundabout way, they're admitting that life is non-material. And that's actually the fact. So, spirit means that which can be understood and experienced by a knowledge system different to the material system. That's the very nature. If you say, well, we can't see spirit, we can't measure it, therefore it doesn't exist, that's foolishness. Because by the very nature of spirit is that it is not perceivable to the material senses, because it's not material. Then you may say it doesn't exist. It's not that it doesn't exist, but it's not on the material platform. There's a very big difference between our inability to perceive something and its existence or non-existence. So you may say, well, this is all faith, but it's not. It's no more classifiable as simply as faith or non-classifiable as knowledge than what we call science. Actually, it's better. That's what I was saying. Because in science, you believe, anyway, what people tell you. But that's always changing, because what appears to be correct in science, it's correct, but the paradigm never fully fits. It's correct under certain conditions, but then if you change the conditions, then it's no longer correct. Not that you change the conditions, but you find when you do more experimentation, you find that what they call knowledge, the paradigm no longer fits. Newtonian physics, they thought, well, that's it. That's the end of now we understand. We know the physical laws of the universe. The Newtonian physics is the template or the background on which all further research will take place. But then they found out that it doesn't fit. We need a new theory. So they don't really, it seems that it fits, but then when you go deeper and deeper, and there's no end to the permutations and combinations that matter can present herself in, then you find that what fits doesn't fit. But real knowledge means that knowledge which doesn't change. That's why I'm saying the knowledge of Shastra, it doesn't change. It remains the same. It's not that we have to alter the Bhagavad Gita because now in the 21st century, people they have flush toilets. So now we become more advanced. So now we have to change the knowledge. Now we have knowledge of atoms and this and that. But no, nothing changes. That's knowledge given by the person who made this whole situation to help us understand our position within it, which, however we study it from the level of physical science or chemistry or biology, or you can study in something just like here in this, what would you call this? This is a upavanam. It's a little grove of few trees. So a botanist would look at it and see it one way, and then a physicist would see it in another way, and then a businessman saying, I could purchase this and then after 10 years sell it, or I can make a housing scheme here. Businessman, a lusty man might think, hey, I could bring my girlfriend here. Different people see it in different. A devotee comes and thinks, let's chant Hare Krishna here. That's what we're doing. So different people see it in different ways. But the knowledge of Shastra means to see the universe through the eyes of he who has made the universe and knows the purpose of it. So this is the best knowledge. And the success of life is to come to the platform of understanding that knowledge which will release us from all material miseries. We're studying this world, but what is the purpose of life? That should be the first question. We just presume. We go through the whole educational system and it's just presumed by everyone that by getting a good education, getting a good job and money, that's the purpose of life. But no one's happy, and increasingly in the modern age everyone is miserable and suffering from all kinds of physical and mental diseases. And then you die and they say, well, death, everything is finished. No proof, just blind faith. They say death, everything is finished, because matter is only combination. Life is just a combination of matter. No proof, completely unscientific statement, nothing whatsoever to even begin to prove it, but just on blind faith, they say that at death everything is finished. But we understand from the Vedic version it's not finished, because the body is not life. It's the soul within the body that makes the body appears to be alive. Although the body is only chemicals, it's not actually alive. It's the presence of the soul that makes it alive. And therefore, in every language of the world, when someone dies, they say, he has gone away. Chalega. Chalegeche. How do you say in Tamil? I asked this several times. Poita. Poita in Bengali, that means eta poita. It's called a poita. Something like that. Any other languages here? We also have some Telugu people here. How do you say it in Telugu? When someone dies?
Poyadu.
Huh?
Poyadu.
Poyadu. Something like that.
Yeah.
Any Keralites here? Same as Tamil. He means he went to Tamil Nadu? Where did you go? Gone anyway in every language of the world, when someone dies, you say he's gone away. That means that people, the body's there. Yeah, what do you mean gone away? It's still there. Hey! Time for breakfast. No. Instead of cooking breakfast, you'll be cooked. The body will be cooked. Gone away. Why did they say? Intrinsically, everyone knows the soul is different from the body. It's gone. Something's gone. What's gone? Life is gone. That is the soul. So success means to come to the platform whereby we don't have to suffer anymore. We come to the platform of eternal happiness. That is possible on the spiritual platform. That is real success. That is the message of Bhagavad Gita. Lord Krishna is speaking to Arjuna, who wanted to run away from killing many people. And Krishna told him that actually no one is born, no one dies. Na jayate mriyate va kadachin nayang bhutva bhavita va na bhuyaha ajo nityang shashvato yang purano na hanyate hanyamane shariri. For the soul there is no birth or death. He does not ever come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever existing and undying. These are all synonyms practically. The soul neither slays anyone nor is slayed. Now this has to be understood in context. That doesn't mean that you have a license to just go and kill anyone. But the point is that the bodies that we are inhabiting are temporary. We don't have any real identification with the body. It's not really us. The body is temporary, but we are eternal. The human form of life is an opportunity to understand that and act in such a way that we don't have to get born again. We come to the platform of Satchidananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss, which is possible in the service of Krishna, who is the supreme eternity, knowledge, and bliss, the supreme person, the supreme scientist. You're studying the laws of nature. The laws are all put into place by Krishna. He's the biggest brain, much bigger than millions of Einsteins put together. He gave Einstein the brain and he gave him the intelligence and in due course of time took it away also. The laws of nature are there. Do you really think it came into being by chance? Isn't that a ridiculous proposition? All is so complex, it came into being by chance. I've given this example hundreds of times. I'll give it one more time. It's a very good example. If I told you that this steel dhaba came into being by chance, you wouldn't believe it, would you? That there was a storm one day, and in the backyard there was some garbage, and I saw all the garbage blow together, and it came like this, just like this dhaba. You see, and it just exactly fits. It's not, the lid isn't too tight, and it's not too loose either. It's just convenient. How much intelligence went into making this? Someone designed it. Someone had the theoretical concept of such a thing, and then to extract the iron ore, to find the iron ore, to process it and make it into steel, all different experiments to make the right quality of steel. What kind of steel is suitable for this? How thick it should be, not too thick, not too thin. And then marketing it, transporting it, taxing it. That's also there. Everything's taxable in this country. Pretty much. Maybe the potatoes in the market aren't, but everything else. So how much intelligence went into this? No one would accept this came into being by chance. And this is relatively simple, and the whole universe is so incredibly complex. How can you possibly believe that it came into being by chance? But people in the name of science say that the whole universe came into being by chance. Big fools! You've been fooled! They're teaching you this, and you believe it. And just by this simple example, you should be able to, of course, our dedicated scientists will come out with a big volley of long words which no one understands. But the simple example is that this simple thing, relatively simple, is not, if you think about it, it's not so simple. I just gave the example of, you know, extracting the iron ore and finding it, and you know, so many things. So much intelligence has to go into this. It's nicely made so it doesn't rust and doesn't leak. Might make if you put it like that. Pretty good, huh? Oh, just a few drops came out. Pretty well made. Nothing special about it. You don't, when you see this, you don't start fainting at how wonderful it is. But you couldn't believe for a second that it came into being by chance. So why do you believe the whole universe has come into being by chance? Definitely there's some intelligence behind the universe. Success of life means to understand, intelligently understand that supreme intelligent person. To claim that such a supremely intelligent person doesn't exist is blind, foolish faith. To accept that he exists is reasonable faith. So please don't graduate into the ignorance of thinking that I shall be a success simply by materialistic development, but become a graduate of the bhakti school. And the success is getting out of this material world and going to Krishna in the spiritual world to live there eternally in a life of pure bliss and knowledge in the service of Krishna. Hare Krishna. Does anyone have any questions, please?
But then, who can Krishna?
Do we have any other mic? Only this one. All right, say it. And how can Krishna?
How can we perceive Krishna?
How can we perceive Krishna? Well, if you say, how can we perceive Krishna, first of all, that means you accept that Krishna exists. So we can perceive Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna is the Supreme Person. So we can perceive Krishna by the method that he gives us to perceive him. Not by any material means. Seeing is an act of the senses, right? We presume that seeing is an act of the effect of light on the retina, which is processed within the brain. We presume that to be seeing. But who is the seer? If the soul is not in the body, then you can have good eyes. I mean, you can donate your eyes. The eyes are still good. People do that, don't they? They say, after I die, I'll give my eyes in charity. So the eye is still good, but you can't... That eye... E-Y-E cannot, it has the material ability to see, but it doesn't see because the soul is not within the body. So that's, in Vedic language, that's called the antakarana, the internal perceiver, the internal senses, which are necessary. And it may be that even without these gross senses, one can see. You can see in your mind's eye. That's there, isn't it? Mind's eye. A person who, say someone throws acid in his face, and he's blinded. But he can still, within his mind, if someone says to him that there's a green bird in front of you. He can still visualize that. So seeing is that it's all the functions of the senses, they are functions of consciousness, which is a symptom of the soul. And when one's senses are purified and spiritualized, then through the spiritual function of the senses, we can see Krishna. But you have to be trained to recognize him. Just like a botanist, who can tell the names of these trees? This is a bale tree. That you can tell from the fruit where he is. Well, if you know, most of you know a mango tree, that's another popular tree. You have a mango tree here. Where's the mangoes?
No mangoes.
Should be in this season.
Yeah.
No one watered the tree again. What happened? So a botanist could tell us all the names of these trees. I don't know the other ones. The fruit trees mostly, we know. And maybe the Latin names also. So I just see a tree. A botanist sees. The point is that the more you're trained in knowledge, it's not just the effect on the retina, but how you process that and what it. Just like a car, Mercedes-Benz car. Now, a child may see a. You know, you were in the car industry before you came to Krishna consciousness. You all know Mercedes-Benz, it's a prestigious car. They make them in India now. So, a child would see an object. He may not even know what a car is. But then as he gets a little bit older, by about the age of 4 or 5, you can understand this is a car, and we drive here and there in a car. Then when he gets a little older, he can understand that this car is prestigious. It's a Mercedes-Benz car. So, actually, Mercedes-Benz car and Maruti car, they both perform basically the same function. But Mercedes-Benz car is considered prestigious because it's very expensive. And it's comfortable and it has some facilities. Well, it goes fast. So, there's... You see what I'm saying? That... That you can perceive it by the impression on the retina. But then as you have more knowledge of it, then you can understand more about it. So you might see Krishna, but unless you have knowledge of who is Krishna, you wouldn't recognize how important he is. So seeing is not just a matter... I was saying, like the experimentation to, we can't say to prove the existence of the electron, but to demonstrate it. One has to be knowledgeable to understand that, yes, this experiment demonstrates the existence of the electron. So someone says, show me God. Well, if someone doesn't even believe in the existence of God and they say, show me God, then how can you show to such a person? Because they don't believe in the existence anyway. They may see a person, but they don't believe that any person is God, so they'll never see God, even though he is God, because they don't believe that such a person exists, or they don't believe that there's such a designation, or that there is any God. So how are you going to show to someone who doesn't believe, who's determined not to believe? Just like we find in Mahabharata, it's described that Krishna went as a messenger to Duryodhana on behalf of the Pandavas to sue for peace. And Duryodhana thought, Krishna is the life of the Pandavas. So let me capture him, and then the Pandavas, they will be distraught, and then they won't have any energy to fight. And just by capturing Krishna, then I'll immediately conquer over the Pandavas. So Krishna, being antaryami in everyone's heart, he could understand this. So he walked into the court and said, oh, all right, Duryodhana, so you'd like to catch me, huh? All right, so which one do you want to catch? And then Duryodhana, wherever he looked, he saw Krishna. Krishna, There's Krishna here, Krishna there, Krishna, Krishna, everywhere Krishna. And Krishna told him, actually I'm the Supreme Lord and I favor the Pandavas, so you can't be successful. But he thought, oh, it's just some magic trick. Even though he could see that this Krishna is doing something which is not possible for everyone else, because he was a determined atheist, he refused to accept that that Krishna is Bhagavan, even though he demonstrated it. So how are you going to prove something to someone who's determined not to believe it anyway? It requires some faith. Just like if I'm determined to say that there's no such thing as an electron, you can show the experimenter and say, it's just some hocus pocus. That doesn't show anything. So knowledge and faith are not, as is wrongly promulgated in the so-called, in the modern so-called scientific ethos, they're not mutually contradictory. They're mutually interdependent. Real faith has to be based on some knowledge. Just like when you walk on the road, it's an act of faith. You have faith that the pavement in front of you will support you. But that's not, it's faith, isn't it? You don't know. You don't actually know. You don't, before you go ahead, make some measurements and, you know, bang it to see if it's strong enough. But you have faith, and it's reasonable faith based on knowledge. So we call it knowledge, but actually if we have to prove everything at every moment, you couldn't even eat anything. You couldn't even breathe. How do I know that the air is not poisoned? Someone might have poisoned the air. Someone might have put cyanide in there. Potassium cyanide in there. Might have done, but every time I have to make an experiment to test, and just drink the water. So faith is inherent in everything we do. Faith and knowledge are interdependent completely. It's just a matter of reason. What is reasonable faith and what is unreasonable faith? It's unreasonable faith or foolishness to accept, for instance, that Sai Baba is Bhagavan, because he doesn't show the symptoms of it. He might have the ability to produce some ashes, but he doesn't possess the symptoms of Bhagavan as described in Shastra. Aishvaryasya samagrasya viryasya yashasya shriha jnana vairagya yoshtraiva shandang bhaga itingena. All wealth, everything belongs to him. Everything is within his control. He doesn't have that. He has a little ashram in Andhra Pradesh. He's not the owner of everything. All power. He doesn't have all power. All fame. He doesn't have all fame. Next one is beauty. He definitely doesn't have all beauty. That's for sure. One of the ugliest mutts in the history of the world. He doesn't have all knowledge. He's not a pundit. He's not even by traditional standards anything even approaching a pundit. And he's not a vairagi. He's not renounced, no. He eats onions and everything. He's a vegetarian, but he eats onions, which is pretty low class. And he's in a wheelchair, I heard now. So what kind of Bhagavan is that? So that's unreasonable faith. But reasonable faith is to accept Krishna as supreme, because young Brahma, Varunendra, Rudra, Marutas, Stunvanti, Divyai, Stavai, all the demigods, all the great gods, they accept him as Bhagavan. All the Shastras, Vedaisha Sarve Rahameva Vedaha, in all the Vedas, the object of knowledge is Krishna. Sarve Veda, Yad Padama Mananti, all the Vedas indicate him. So that's reasonable. It's just that you've had an unreasonable education, that's all. Because they want you to work very hard and make the whole, you know, someone somewhere is making a lot of money, and they bluff you into thinking that you're a success if you can work hard and work hard and work hard and have a nervous breakdown, and they don't give a damn, and that's it. You've been bluffed. So graduate out of this foolishness and come to the real life of bliss and knowledge in Krishna consciousness. This is our suggestion, request, plea, recommendation, or whichever way you want to take it. Hare Krishna. Any other question?
Maharaj, one more question I want to know. How can the Bhagwan realization exist? That is, it's above the Brahman realization. How can it be that Bhagwan is above the Brahman?
Bhagavan and Brahma, they're no, same. Brahman, the Advaya Jnana, same. Vedanti tat tatva viras tatvam yaj jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabhyate. The three aspects of the same indivisible truth. The most complete aspect is understanding of Bhagavan. How can it be? How can it not be? It's only because you have perverted way of thinking that you think it's that imperson should be superior to person. Why do you think that formless should be superior to form? Why? Any reason for it?
He's telling it could be more subtle.
More what?
Subtle.
More subtle? Well, Krishna is the supreme person. But that, you see, the person, the form of Krishna is not limited as our forms are limited. Your or our forms are presently situated within the IIT campus in Chennai. And it's only here. It's not also in the, you know, on the beach in Chennai or in the IIT Kharagpur. It's limited. But Krishna, even though the form is there, but he's simultaneously present everywhere. So the form is not for Krishna a limiting factor. So it has everything, the form of Krishna possesses everything that the impersonal Brahman has and more also. Brahmano hi pratishtaham. Krishna is the basis of that impersonal Brahman. So, that was the theory, and now for the practical. How can you see God? Chant Hare Krishna. Seeing comes first through the ear, that's stated in the Shastra. Shutikshana Patha. It's the same in your whatever field. First of all, you have to hear, isn't it? You learn by hearing. So we hear the sound of Krishna's name that purifies the consciousness. And it gives us immediate entrance into the spiritual platform of bliss. So chanting Hare Krishna is the blissful platform of the soul. So let's do that. And even from our grossly material condition, if we chant Hare Krishna, then by the grace of Krishna, we can begin to experience the beauty and the mercy of Krishna and the joy of Krishna, of bhakti to Krishna. It requires a little faith. That's why I was saying we know who the new ones are, because the new ones who are coming are standing there. They're not quite sure what to make of it. But you have to loosen up a little bit and accept them. Yeah, well, we don't have to be hard-nosed scientists. We can also chant Hare Krishna. It's the topmost science. Raja Vidya in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says. This is the king of all knowledge. So let's chant Hare Krishna, and after that there'll be prasadam for everyone. Spiritual food. That's wonderful, isn't it? Food sanctified by the mercy of Krishna.